Dan Krim is zipping himself into a hazmat suit. He's in his garage, covering every inch of skin before he sets foot inside his home.
I never thought I was going to be in a situation like this.
Yet, here he is. He puts on goggles, gloves, a respirator, and steps inside. A smoke alarm with a dead battery beeps in the stairwell. That's just one of the signs Dan Krim abandoned this home. It's a one-story, pale yellow, prefab house in a Laconia subdivision where all the houses look the same. And when they bought the place from Brady Sullivan Properties in 2010, the house was just built, but the Krims say they noticed a huge crack in the foundation.
You can see everywhere I turn, I can be able to look and I can be able to see it.
The basement flooded when it rained. Moisture built up in the house, and mold and yeast sprouted everywhere.
My uniforms, my dress blues that I was handing down to my son. We got tubs of Christmas items. Clothing, baby toys that are in there. Look at the paperwork. How moldy that is.
Dan Krim says the mold made him, his wife, and son sick. Chronic colds, memory loss. They sued Brady Sullivan and fled the house.
When I retired from the military, all I wanted to do was settle down. We trusted, you know, we had a prominent builder.
A few weeks after this interview, the Krims and Brady Sullivan settled the lawsuit for undisclosed terms. But 5 years ago, complaints from homeowners in this subdivision, which is called Paugus Woods, caught the attention of the New Hampshire Department of Justice. The state hired an engineer, and when the engineer inspected about 40 brand new homes, he found 450 code violations. Attorney David Rienzo with the Justice Department says Brady Sullivan had advertised the homes as up to code.
Because that was not true, because that is a promise that was made to the public and a promise that was broken, that provided us with the legal rationale for taking action against Brady Sullivan in this matter.
Taking action meant the Attorney General, the state's top law enforcement agent, sued one of the state's biggest developers. That lawsuit filed in 2011 stated the safety problems in Paugus Woods were...
This is Pam.
Oh, okay. I'm Pam Colantuno.
And this is Minata.
Hi, I'm Minata Ture.
Pam and Minata have never met, but they have a few things in common. They both live in Manchester. They're both moms. And the biggest thing they share, the thing that shapes both their lives and how they see the world, is the classic American immigration story.
I think that my story is not any different than other people's story.
Let's start with the heart of every immigration story, the arrival. Inside Pam's big house on Manchester's North End, the faces of her grandparents and her great-grandparents stare out from framed photographs.
This was the family that immigrated from Greece. This was my grandmother right here.
They immigrated 100 years ago.
Why do you think your family decided to come?
You know, I don't know. I have no idea, to be honest with you. I don't know the exact reason, but I would assume that it was just one of those things that they said, okay, we're going to make a better life for our children.
On the west side of Manchester, on the second floor of a condominium complex, Minata's immigration story starts 4 years ago.
I was just looking for a better life.
She grew up in Burkina Faso, West Africa. She was the first one in her family to go to school, the first one to leave home.
For them, it is so scary going somewhere. Like my mom, she's like, I don't know how you can live there. I just decide to try.
And it was a big risk. She came over alone. She barely spoke English.
So it was like, if you get lost, that is the feeling that I had the first time that I got here.
That feeling of getting lost, it's something Pam doesn't think her family went through when they arrived. They joined a whole community of Greek immigrants already settled in Manchester. We decide to drive across town to that old neighborhood.
At first, it was fresh, new.
We have two candidates at tonight's debate, and they are Republican Frank Ginta and Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter.
Then, 2 years later, a political reboot.
They are incumbent Republican Frank Ginta and Democrat Carol Shea Porter.
By 2014, it was like, okay, the rubber match.
The incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter, her Republican challenger, former Congressman Frank Ginta. Now, let's be honest, there's a history between these two candidates.
Yeah, there sure is. And time hasn't exactly brought them any closer. When they meet face to face, it's not hard to find snippy exchanges, including this from earlier in the week.
Wow. Well, you didn't get six bills signed, but we'll leave that aside. The reality is...
Andy Smith is a political science professor at the University of New Hampshire.
After three nasty campaigns already and going into a fourth, I think we have candidates that don't like each other very much, probably don't respect each other very much.
Friendships aside, Shea Porter and Ginta's alternating success seems to be less tied to their political beliefs. Neither candidate strays very much from their party line. Instead, the revolving door seems more a result of what's happening higher up the ticket at the national level.
It wasn't so long ago that Michael Burgart managed a restaurant. He was on the up and up. He was getting methadone at a clinic every morning. He was going to work. He was staying sober.
What occurred is got incarcerated.
Now he's a line cook. He's back to square one. We met at a Dunkin' Donuts just blocks from the Valley Street Jail in Manchester, the same jail he was locked up at a few months earlier. Every time he goes to jail, Burgart says he has to detox from methadone. And when he gets out, he relapses.
You know, it causes you to get back in the circle of addiction that you were just about, you know, maybe at the end of.
Burgart is 32. He's been working on staying sober for a decade with the help of methadone, a slow-acting opiate doctors use.
Donald Trump was characteristically adamant at a recent town hall meeting in Claremont.
And all I do is tell the truth. I tell the truth. I tell the truth.
And the truth, Trump went on to say, is that he's raring to take on Hillary Clinton come November, but...
I have to get rid of these other people first. No, you have to get rid of them first.
Trump was talking about his rivals for the GOP nomination, yet to hear former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu tell it on Bloomberg TV last week, if Trump succeeds, he'll also be getting rid of scores of local Republicans next fall.
Here in New Hampshire, if Donald Trump's the nominee, we will not get a Republican governor. We will lose the New Hampshire State Senate, and we could lose the New Hampshire State House. It is that bad, and we could lose Senator Rayon.
Sununu's comments are just a particularly public display of the Trump-inspired hand-wringing that's been going on for months in some GOP circles. And it all comes as Republicans here prepare for a tough election season, in which Kelly Ayotte is facing a revolt from her party's far-right wing, and Congressman Frank Ginta will test his luck with voters for the first time since admitting a campaign finance violation he'd been denying for years. Adding Donald J. Trump to this mix just complicates things. Ask Ayotte about him, and you get a practiced response and a sense she'd rather talk about other things.
Well, listen, I mean, I think it's a favorite question of the press to ask all of us what we think about Trump, but, you know, I plan to support our Republican nominee, but I think there's a long way to go till that decision is made.
And warmers, $5 a pair, cash or card.
Attend any Trump rally. The one in Claremont attracted 1,000 people on a 10-degree night, and it doesn't take long to find Republicans like Alex Carpenter, voters who say they're through towing the party line.
I'm a registered Republican, but I'm not going to hold my nose and vote for whoever the Republican candidate is. Done with those games. I want true guys in who are going to actually do what they said they'd do.
Carpenter knows he won't vote for Kelly Ayotte this fall, but is less certain about who will...
At 27 years old, Barbara Aguayo's seen a lot. When she was 7, she, her mom, and 5 brothers and sisters left home in the middle of the night to get away from their abusive father. They landed on the streets of Manchester, living homeless for a while. As the years went on, things didn't get much better. An abusive partner, rough group of friends, her education stopped in high school. And all that shapes how she walks through the world, what she expects from life.
It gives me a lot of trust issues. I'm actually pretty much a hardball.
Aguayo wants to give her 2 sons a safer, happier life than she had here on Manchester's East Side. But she says this can be a rough place to raise kids.
The East Side is not a very good neighborhood. This last year, I think it was right at the end of the school year, we were actually playing in the park right across the street, and we didn't realize, but there were shootings happening right there on the corner on the other side of the park, and our kids are playing.
Aguayo lives in Ward 5, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Manchester. I met her while she was volunteering at the Beach Street Elementary School, which both her sons attend. And here at Beach Street, 95% of the kids qualify for free or reduced lunch. The median income level for parents is around $25,000. That's less than half of Manchester's. A lot of kids live in households where English isn't the main language. A lot of immigrants and refugees live here. And those factors, being poor, less likely to speak English, less education, turn out to be the recipe for low voter turnout, research shows. Ward 5 has one of the lowest turnout rates in New Hampshire. Two-thirds of the people here don't vote, including Barbara Aguayo.
Voting, I do not do. Just like my mom, we do not vote. I deal with a lot more than dealing with who's running my country.
What she's dealing with are raising her kids and just surviving. And she doesn't see politics playing any role in that. And
Aguayo, if you're doing something illegal, the last person you'd willingly call is probably the police. Well, that's not always the case in Laconia, at least when it comes to using drugs.
What do I do? You know, my dealer's blowing up my phone. It's driving me crazy. What do I do?
That's Police Officer Eric Adams, talking about one of the many calls he gets at all hours from those battling a drug addiction in the community. Adams was hired by the Laconia Police Department about a year and a half ago as its prevention and treatment coordinator. Adams goes to overdose calls, talks of users, connects them with treatment, and even gives them rides to some services.
And you talk with them. You explain to them, look, you're better than this. You don't answer that phone. You know, you kind of just, you work through it. And it's not rocket science. You care. That's what it is. You show them that you actually care.
He also hands each person he meets a card with links to treatment, insurance coverage, and his personal cell phone number, which he answers.
If there was a moment when Corey Lewandowski's value to the Trump campaign was confirmed, it came primary night in New Hampshire when Trump won big on Lewandowski's home turf.
Corey, where is Corey? Does Corey have a ground game or what? Boy, do we have a ground game? Where's Corey? Corey Lewandowski.
Lewandowski was standing stage right to Trump, looking relaxed. It was a rare moment of rest for Lewandowski, who's known for guzzling energy drinks and being in constant motion. Lewandowski had never run a national campaign before. Now he's Trump's alter ego.
And I think it's time to send someone to Washington who's willing to fundamentally change the system and make America great again. There's only one guy willing to do that, Trump.
At 41, Lewandowski spent half his life in politics, mostly in low-profile positions. Before signing on with Trump, Lewandowski was known in New Hampshire political circles for mock debating a cardboard cutout of former Governor John Lynch at Tea Party rallies.
This is an actual life-size image of the governor, 5 feet 4 inches tall.
One way that Colin Van Ostern highlights his experience in the private sector is in his TV ads. A recent one opens with Van Ostern lifting boxes, presumably full of yogurt, into a Stonyfield truck.
I'm Colin Van Ostern, and I learned a lot as a business leader at Stonyfield Yogurt, like how to keep families healthy.
Van Ostern is then seen riding shotgun in the Stonyfield truck as a voiceover outlines his plans for New Hampshire. He's pictured speaking to men in jeans and hard hats and women in pink Planned Parenthood shirts, and all of them are eating out of cups of yogurt. In fact, every single shot in the 30-second ad features Stonyfield in some way. It's been 3 years since Van Ostern actually worked at Stonyfield, but ads like this make it clear he sees his time there as a key item on his resume as he seeks the governor's office. Here he is telling voters as much at a campaign stop this summer.
By the time I was 35 years old, I was responsible for $100 million worth of business a year at Stonyfield. And here's what I learned.
Van Ostern started at Stonyfield in 2011. At the time, the 32-year-old was already well into a career in politics. He had worked on the campaigns of Democrats Jeanne Shaheen, John Edwards, John Kerry, and Annie Custer. But in 2007, Van Ostern enrolled in Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business in an apparent move to take a break from politics.
Jim Lawrence talks a lot about the company he started in 2003, Lawrence Battelle Incorporated.
My small business started as a consulting firm that made recommendations to the Department of Defense for how they can reduce their government spending.
He describes working side by side with the military and government employees and advising the Department of Defense on, quote, long-term decisions about major weapon systems.
We were actually embedded with the Department of Defense and advising them specifically on some of the decisions they were making for the sustainment tail. In other words, how they were going to actually maintain this fleet of, at the time, 33 aircraft we had worldwide.
But outside of Jim Lawrence's campaign for Congress, we could find little trace of this company. Lawrence Battelle Incorporated does not show up in federal databases, which include all contracts and subcontracts over $25,000. We searched from 2003, when the company was founded, through today. NHPR asked why we could find no evidence of Jim Lawrence doing business with the federal government. Lawrence responded, his company was too small to be reported. We asked for documentation of his firm's work, and Lawrence replied,
well, I could send you evidence of it, but I probably wouldn't.
Follow-up emails from NHPR seeking details on the company's record have gone unanswered. Lawrence says he left the company in 2014.
We're winding through the pumpkins and the freshly picked produce, Chris Owens and I, at his farm stand on Route 175 in Ashland. I'm not here to buy corn or lettuce. I'm here to find out about Owens' brand new amenity.
I've always wanted to build an outhouse here.
Cool, I say, because one, cool, follow your dreams, and two, well, I can't think of a two yet. But there it is, a great wooden outhouse by the side of the road, right in front of his farm stand.
You can look in the toilet if you want. I'd say there's at least 100.
Look in the toilet. 100? 100 what? We head toward the outhouse, I guess, to look.
So I thought we'd have an outhouse, and then I thought, well, we should have a two-seater so people can both sit in there.
This is sound. This is practical. It's terrifying.
We'll have an old Sears catalog. That's what people used for toilet paper way back then.
But then, a stroke of insight, of bathroom genius. At some point during the construction phase, a eureka moment.
Then I'm thinking, a polling booth is almost the exact same size as an outhouse.
So Owens painted a sign over the outhouse door that reads, Official New Hampshire Voting Booth, and then set a mannequin on either side of the two-seater.
We called around, we had to go to Massachusetts to get a Trump mask and a Hillary mask.
And Owens put the masks on the mannequins and plugged some flags into the roof, and then, above the Donald Trump mannequin, he set up a sign that reads,
If I am elected, we will build a wall between Plymouth and Romney will pay for it. It's classic.
Classic, but I was still a little confused.
So it's a working two-seater outhouse. So then when you use it, it's like you're voting?
No, that would be so disgusting. Right in front of a vegetable, organic vegetable stand to put a freestanding outhouse.
So it is a freestanding outhouse in front of an organic vegetable stand, but it's one of those decorative ones, and you don't vote the way I thought.
When he was a kid, politics shaped Jay Flanders' life. His dad was state treasurer, so after school was spent running around the halls of the state house. As an adult, Jay Flanders is a guy who actually shapes politics. He's not the guy that likes to be out front. He prefers to do his business back in the proverbial smoke-filled room.
First of all, there's no smoking in the State House, so there's no smoke-filled rooms. Not anymore.
Flanders was Senate Chief of Staff for the Republican majority. He's consulted on campaigns, and he's agreed to meet me at this coffee shop in Concord to talk about a part of politics that chances are doesn't come up at your dinner table. The intricate, obscure process of political redistricting. Or the story of how Republicans gerrymandered New Hampshire's Senate map. It's okay. We can say it. Gerrymandering. Flanders says it.
Gerrymandering may be distasteful. In the more extreme cases, it is hardcore bare-knuckle politics. But everyone agreed the map was going to change.
So let's set the scene. 2010, Tea Party outrage helps Republicans sweep the New Hampshire State House. One of the starkest political flips any state makes. Republicans come out of that with the biggest state house majority they've had in a generation.
A new era of government in Concord as new members of the House and Senate were sworn into office.
That was also the year of the census, when a state gets new numbers about who and how many people it has and redraws its political map to reflect those shifts. And in New Hampshire, it's the party in power that holds the pen. Translation, a big political opportunity for the new Republican majority. They got to draw fresh maps for the House, the Senate, and the Executive Council. The Senate map was Flanders' job.
Republican senators wanted a map that would continue to elect Republican senators.
And this is not a moment that attracts protests on the State House lawn, but this may be the most important thing Republicans get to do that term, drawing the political map that'll be in play for the next decade. So Flanders and his team get to work.
In the large, stately lobby of the New Hampshire Historical Society in Concord, a group of fourth graders is ushered up a set of marble stairs. Peggy Hallisey, a museum teacher with the Historical Society, captures their attention and begins motioning toward the artifacts that adorn the walls.
Now, I'd like you to look over here at the eagle. This is the actual real eagle that was on top of the State House when it was built back in 1818.
These students from McClellan Elementary School in Rochester are on a field trip that fourth graders in New Hampshire have been going on since 1964. Each year, about 70% of all fourth graders in the state visit the Historical Society. And for many schools, this visit is a capstone to a year's worth of curriculum on New Hampshire state history.
Here's the musket right here. And you can see, you know what's cool about this musket?
But according to Elizabeth De Brule, Director of Education at the Historical Society, what used to be a capstone is becoming a substitute for a history education that she says students are no longer receiving in the classroom.
We used to employ a very Socratic method with the kids. We would try keeping them engaged through asking a lot of questions, drawing on what they knew. We had to change that because you would ask questions and it would be crickets. I mean, they didn't know. They weren't getting the background.
It's a problem the Historical Society is dubbing the history deficit. De Brule and the museum teachers here seem to have no shortage of alarming anecdotes to support that claim. Students who named ISIS as America's enemy in the Revolutionary War, or who were unable to name the president during the Civil War.
It's been pretty shocking. We've had kids from Manchester schools who, when they came through our field trip, have said they had no idea there were mills in Manchester. They had no idea what those brick buildings were.
While we're talking about public safety, Governor Hassan, I wanted to ask you about guns, with mass shootings becoming a regular headline, including just this weekend where five people were killed at a shopping mall outside Seattle. You've said that you support the right to own guns for personal safety, hunting, and recreation, but those rights must be balanced with public safety. How would you, as a U.S. senator, try to achieve that balance, Governor Hassan? Please be specific.
Sure. Well, I do support the Second Amendment right to responsibly own firearms for the very reasons you just listed, hunting, recreation, defense of one's home. And I think we have a long tradition in New Hampshire of balanced approach here to gun safety. I do think that we should have expanded background checks in this country, something, again, where I differ from my opponent. In the wake of the horror in Orlando, she had the opportunity to vote to expand background checks so terrorists and other people who shouldn't have guns wouldn't be able to buy them online or at gun shows. She has again declined to do that. I would certainly support expanding
background. That's no buy. That's what people call it.
It actually is, yeah, beyond that, but it's making sure they can't buy them at gun shows and online. And so she has declined to do that. I would support that. I also would support an assault weapon ban.
So you said expand background checks, and you touched on that, but give us a little bit more, Governor Hassan. So this has been a point of tension between Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
You would expand background checks to gun shows and online.
Right. Right now, a known or suspected terrorist who might be prevented from buying a gun at a gun store can still go online or to gun shows and buy guns. And that's what the whole debate about expanding background checks is about.
It is no secret drugs like OxyContin and hydromorphone are highly addictive. The real question is this: do drug companies downplay how addictive they are while marketing the medicine to doctors? New Hampshire's Attorney General Joe Foster suspects false marketing of legal pills has led to abuse of illicit drugs like heroin. That's why he subpoenaed the nation's largest manufacturers of prescription painkillers.
If they are continuing to mislead the public, we're going to continue to improperly create addicts in our state. 4 out of 5 folks who turned to heroin were addicted to prescription opiates first.
The AG demanded upwards of 1 million pages of marketing records from five companies: Octavis, Endo, Janssen, Teva, and Purdue Pharma. James Buffetti is the state's lead attorney on this investigation, and earlier this summer, he told a Superior Court judge that it had been a year since the state subpoenaed the drug companies.
I've yet to receive one piece of paper from any of these drug companies, and you got to ask yourself, why? Why are they fighting so hard?
They're not only fighting hard in New Hampshire. The city of Chicago, the state of Mississippi.
When I got off the train at Kottbusser Tor at noon one day in Berlin, the first thing I saw was a young woman stooped on the steps, smoking heroin. She was out in the open, tinfoil on display, and lighter in hand. And once I exited the platform, the second thing I saw were two police cruisers stationed there. This is normal here.
Sometimes there are up to 100 person at this corner. It's a drug user, and there are a lot of people, the crowd, standing over there.
Astrid Leitch heads the nonprofit Fixpunk. The group runs needle exchange programs in Berlin, including a mobile one that stops by this area three times a week. Leitch says when it comes to arresting drug users, it's not the police department's priority. Berlin's lead detective within the narcotics department, Michel Wolfert, can vouch for this. He says the city's officers are trained not to treat addicts as criminals.
Addiction is not a crime, it's a disease, you know? And we got to adapt ourselves and our work to this philosophy. But basically, the mentality concerning dealers and organized crime groups that smuggling drugs into Germany keep the same way. Enforcement, enforcement, enforcement.
And enforcement is centered on high-level dealers. Recently, his department seized 80 kilograms of heroin, which is 10 times the amount seized in 2015. When dealers do get arrested, the jail time they face is significantly less than in the States. The highest sentence for dealing in Germany is up to 15 years, half what one could serve in New Hampshire. And for anyone with a sentence less than 2 years, even low-level dealers, there's the option of going to a drug treatment program rather than jail. Berlin's drug czar, Christine Kuhler-Azara, says they believe locking people up doesn't work.
People are not deciding by that.
Donald Trump's New Hampshire inner circle spent yesterday afternoon soaking in the sun and downing beers outside the convention hall. The gang was all there. Trump's ex-campaign manager Corey Lewandowski posed for selfies with a stream of admirers.
Corey, my hero, man. My hero. Thank you, Corey. Pleasure to meet you.
Londonderry State Rep Al Baldessaro puffed cigarettes and spat insults at his party's state chair, lone statewide office holder, and the leader of the New Hampshire House.
Only in my own state do I got three idiots that have no damn clue on the Constitution and the laws of the land. And that's Kelly Ayotte, Jennifer Horn, and also Jasper. You know what I mean?
Sitting across the table, Fred Doucette, one of Trump's state co-chairmen, said he was proud the New York businessman saw him as worthy of leading his local campaign.
Again, I'm humbled by that, and but for him to link it to me was an indicator to me. And I'm lucky enough to have seen, you know, intimately what he does and how he does it, and I just sit nodding. All right, this guy's got our back.
Trump's other state co-chairman, Steve Stepanek, meanwhile assured anyone with an earshot that Donald Trump's success in the primary was just the beginning.
As this movement continues to build, I think not only are we going to win, I think it's going to be an overwhelming win. And there's a tsunami coming, and people still don't get it.
I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR. All this week on Morning Edition, we're bringing you a week-long series on the heroin and opioid addiction crisis. We're calling it Hope on the Front Lines. We're traveling across the state and talking with people at the ground level that are trying to make a difference. One way people are trying to help is through recovery coaching, a peer support model that's growing in the state. Coaches support those in recovery by helping access treatment and other resources, like finding a job and a safe place to live as they try to get clean. To learn more, I recently joined about 40 people at a Recovery Coach Academy in a hotel conference room in Concord.
My name is Kathy Sari. I'm from New Ipswich, New Hampshire, and I pastor a church there.
Dave Simpson, full-time firefighter EMT with the town of Pittsfield.
I'm Melissa O'Brien, and I am from Nashua, New Hampshire. And I want to jump on that bandwagon to really learn how to combat this epidemic.
Everyone I speak to wants to help, but perhaps no one in the room is feeling a sense of urgency like Kyle McDonald of Franklin.
It's unfortunate. You know, I actually had a friend pass away just last night of an overdose. I got home after going to a recovery meeting, and I got home and, you know, come to find out my buddy's, he passed away, you know, and it's, I mean, this is just an amazing person, you know, someone who had so much to give and, like, love, and he's gone, and we're losing people like that, and that's just an example. Like, it happens every day.
When that something like that happens, when you get a phone call like that, what is your first thought?
I really just wonder what could have stopped it, because it's a waste.
Like many here, McDonald is in recovery himself.
Sitting across from me on her porch, Marianne Sylvester's face looks healthy. But she says her face looked different before she got Graves' disease about 10 years ago. At the time, it all seemed like bad luck. Really, really bad luck.
A side effect of Graves is thyroid eye disease, and it causes your eyes to bulge out. And so I lost all self-confidence. You can't look someone in the eye when your eyes are, you feel hideous.
Sylvester spent 4 years like this. Ultimately, surgeons had to remove bone from her face and skull to make room for her swollen eye muscles. It wasn't until the spring of this year that she began wondering if it was more than bad luck that caused this disease. That's when she found out new water tests had shown high levels of the contaminant PFOA in local drinking water. And research links PFOA to thyroid disorders, including Graves' disease.
Graves' disease has affected every aspect of my life. Financially, socially, my career, my family.
If PFOA caused this, Sylvester says, she needs to know. But given the research so far, there's just no good way to know if her disease was caused by these contaminants. And that's the same for dozens, maybe hundreds of residents in New Hampshire alone who have contaminated water and who suffer everything from high cholesterol.
A woman named Ami lets us into her room up on the second floor of the PK Motel. Her long brown hair is pinned up high. She holds an unlit cigarette in her hand.
Like I said, I don't have much sitting room. You can sit on the edge of the bed.
Ami, who's asked us not to use her last name, has packed her whole life into this room. Plastic bins of clothes, boxes of canned food she gets from the food pantry and heats up in her microwave.
The object she says is most important to her, a photo of her holding her daughter in the hospital just after she was born.
I've never been without that picture. That picture has always been beside my bed, no matter where I've been or where I've lived.
The PK Motel rises up over a big, dusty parking lot, partway down a rural road in Effingham, close to the Maine border and wedged between the lakes and the White Mountains. The place looks more like a warehouse than a motel. It's not a place families stop on vacation. It's where local town welfare offices send people when they're out of options.
And behind each of these doors are stories of people stranded by poverty. Stories about addiction, violence, rural isolation, bad luck, bad choices. For Ovi Sharest, who's 31, he says he's stuck because he can't get a job.
Jobs around here are tough. The rates aren't that good. They're awful.
Ovi lives just a couple doors down from Ami. He says even if he had a job, he couldn't get to it because, like a lot of folks at this motel, he doesn't have a car. When we talk to him, he's just about to take a 3-hour round-trip walk to the nearest grocery store with his friend Francesca Wright.
Wright says when most jobs are low wage and part-time, it's hard to get a leg up and out of a place like this. She works at McDonald's.
I'm 30 years old. I've got 15, 16 years experience, and they were paying me $7.75.
And me, I've just been struggling financially for a couple of years. That's how I lost my car.
Over on the other side of the building, Stephanie...
The offices of SilverTech, a digital marketing firm in Manchester, are going for that Silicon Valley mystique. There's skee-ball in the hallways, a huge screen to play old-school video games on, and no shortage of well-compensated coders walking around in jeans.
The average wage has certainly gone up. Even the starting wage has gone up, probably $10,000 in the last
you know, 4 or 5 years.
Derek Barca is Senior Director of Technology at SilverTech. They've got about 70 employees and lots of contracts in the pipeline. One problem, though, they're constantly scrambling to find new workers.
It hasn't happened yet, but we've come to situations where, you know, we have work coming in, we have, you know, a certain amount of people in the building, and if there's not people in the building to do the work, you know, you have to turn the work away.
There are lots of New Hampshire companies in SilverTech's shoes right now, and not just those that need highly educated, highly skilled workers. Take the Edgewood Center, a nursing home in Portsmouth.
When you stand in the middle of Jim McLaughlin's croquet court in Rye and look out at Route 1A, you can actually watch the people in passing cars turn their heads as they try to figure out just what they're looking at. McLaughlin is used to this. Even before the court was finished some 17 years ago, he says his neighbors couldn't help but wonder.
People would ask me, you know, what's it going to be? And it was one day, a little bit sarcastic, and I said, a helioport. That night, I got a call from the town fathers in Rye, and they called, it's come to our attention that you think you're building a helioport.
What McLaughlin was building in his backyard was a 6-wicket croquet court with perfectly level lime green turf, designed to make croquet balls roll at a consistent speed. When I arrive, McLaughlin is lounging in a lawn chair. He's wearing white sneakers, white shorts, white polo, and a white cap, traditional croquet attire. He tells me his relationship with croquet actually began with his love for another sport, long-distance running.
I used to run about 50 races a year, you know, like 5Ks and 10Ks. And my wife, who died in 2010, was not a runner. And I'd go, she said, what are you doing today? I'm going to Methuen to run a race or something. And I'd be running, I felt guilty. And she would come with me if there was a good mall, you know. But if there wasn't a good mall, she was going to sit, you know, generally and watch it.
So about 15 years ago, McLaughlin and his wife searched for a sport they could enjoy together. After a few months of trying out croquet, they decided it was time to get serious and build their own court. And even though his wife, Myra,
the machinery inside Connor Bottling doesn't sparkle like it used to. In fact, everything and everybody in here look like they could use a break.
We're the last family-owned independent bottler in the state of New Hampshire. 153 years. Never shut down. Never stopped.
Dan Connor is second in charge. He's the fifth generation of Connor to work here.
In general, I call myself the operations manager, but it's only because it's a title. You pick it. We all do everything here.
And it's been that way since the beginning. The company started in the 1860s bottling beer, and then in the 1890s, they experimented with sodas, though it was called tonic in those days. During Prohibition, other drinks were made out back. A friendly sheriff looked the other way. And then in 1938, they laid out $2,400 for the Dixie, a new bottling machine that has more than earned its keep. Tom Howcroft, the only non-Connor working here today, is proud to show it off.
This is the Dixie. They put it in here, brand new. It's been in this spot ever since, working just about every day.
Watching soda get made is more pleasant than watching, say, sausage get made. Howcroft lines up the gleaming glass bottles.
15-year-old Plymouth sophomore Luke Johnstone remembers the old ski jump.
I didn't like it too much. It was pretty scary. A little wobbly up in the top there. I didn't really like it too much.
Wobbly, and according to a structural engineer, far from safe. So on October 14th, 2015, the 35-year-old structure was torn down, and a capital campaign was hastily organized.
And people from around the world were donating money to get this jump built.
3 months and $65,000 later, the final boards were nailed in place, and the Gene Ross Memorial Ski Jump was ready.
Welcome, everybody, to the state championship jumping meet here at Plymouth. Thank you all for coming.
The first flight of jumpers carry their skis to the top of the four-story wooden tower.
Our next jumper from Plymouth, Nick Ross.
The crowd gazes up the tower as 16-year-old Nick Ross pushes off the bar in a tight crouch and then launches himself.
There he goes! 22.5
meters, that is. Clutching huge skis, Ross climbs the rickety stairs from the bottom of the hill. He says all the attention surrounding the new jump has reinvigorated the Plymouth High team.
This jump got a lot of hype, so it actually built up our team a ton. We normally only have like 8-7 jumpers each year. This year we had 25 jumpers on our team.
Our next jumper from Plymouth, Lucas Johnson. That's a jump of 21 meters.
Our girls team this year from Plymouth just skyrocketed. You know, last year we had two girls on the team. This year we have about 8 or 9. And the girls on our team are just killing it this year. It's awesome. So many great freshmen this year.
Our next jumper from Plymouth, Elizabeth Barker. She's on the hill. That's a jump of 15 meters.
When I'm standing up there waiting, I kind of get a little nervous, like, I don't know how I'm going to do on this jump. Like, is it icy? Is it too fast? And then when I put my skis on and I'm on the bar, I just get excited and I don't have any more nerves.
15-year-old Barker.
It's 8:04. I'm Rick Yanley with NHPR News. Good morning. An unexpected strong showing by Republican State Representative Frank Edelblue left the GOP gubernatorial primary too close to call last night, while Colin Van Ostern handily won the Democratic primary. Edelblue spoke to supporters.
And I have to tell you guys something. So these results are going to be coming in. It's going to be a very late night, probably, maybe even in the morning before we see the final results coming through. But what I can tell you is that Colin Van Ostern is not going to be our next governor.
Edelblue and Executive Counselor Chris Sununu are locked in a tight contest for the GOP nod to challenge Democrat Colin Van Ostern, with Sununu having a slight lead. It was a stark contrast to the down-to-the-wire race on the Republican side. Van Ostern emerged early on as the winner of last night's Democratic primary for governor. Former State Representative Jim Lawrence of Hudson defeated House Majority Leader Jack Flanagan in the race for the Republican nomination in the 2nd Congressional District. Lawrence received a little more than 40% of the vote to Flanagan's 28%. Lawrence previously ran for the seat, and Flanagan says he thinks that influenced the outcome.
I think it was just name recognition. I mean, if you take the other five people, I mean, we got 33% of the votes. I mean, that's an awful lot to overcome. So.
Jim Lawrence now faces incumbent Annie Custer in November. New Hampshire regulators are considering adopting the EPA's recommended drinking water limit for the contaminant PFOA. Monday, the New Jersey committee recommended a much lower limit for safe drinking water there. NHPR's Emily Corwin reports.
Perfluorochemicals like PFOA are found in Teflon and firefighting foam. They've contaminated drinking water near Merrimack and at the former Pease Air Force Base. And many affected here in New Hampshire argue the EPA's advisory level of 70 parts per trillion is just not safe enough. For now, that's the level New Hampshire has adopted. But these residents have been anticipating a report from a state-appointed committee of researchers in New Jersey, and that report came out yesterday. The researchers recommend drinking water contain no more than 14 parts per trillion of the chemical PFOA. That's one-fifth the amount recommended by the feds. However, the New Jersey level does only account for PFOA, while the feds level looks at more contaminants at once. Jim Martin with the state's Department of Environmental Services says it will take New Jersey's new recommendation into consideration as it sets its permanent enforceable standard. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
In sports, Boston's lead in the American League East stands at 2 games over Toronto and Baltimore. Last night, the Orioles beat the Red Sox 6-3. It'll be partly sunny for a while today, turning cloudy this afternoon with a chance of some showers and thunderstorms, highs in the 70s and lower 80s. I'm Rick Yanley. This is NHPR News at 8:07.